From the Sky News Centre at 5, Egypt's president has stepped down after 30 years in power. This is how hundreds of thousands of anti-government protesters in Cairo's main square reacted to the news. They chanted the people have brought down the regime. A military council will now run the country's affairs. Our correspondent Andrew Wilson is with the crowds in Cairo.
A man leapt out of his window and shouted to the people below, Rais Ra! Rais Ra! That means the chief is gone. And at the same time as that man shouted, I heard from the other side this roar go up from the crowd. Quite extraordinary.
Well, Egypt's finance minister, Samir Radwan, believes it's been a peaceful and democratic transition of power.
Now I think Egypt is poised to look to the future and try to rebuild the country. I think we all have learned many lessons.
In other news, West Ham looks poised to move into London's Olympic Stadium following the 2012 Games. Their bid has won the recommendation of the Olympic Park Legacy Company. The university tutor of the murdered landscape architect, Joe Yates, has paid tribute to her at her funeral today, saying she was destined for great things. The service took place in the village in Hampshire where Joe grew up. Birmingham City Council says it's slashing £200 million from its budget with the loss of up to 2,500 posts. West Sussex County Council estimates 1,300 jobs will go as it looks to make savings of £79 million. The son of Pink Floyd guitarist David Gilmour have been charged in connection with the attack on the Royal Convoy carrying Charles and Camilla during a student fees riot last December. Charlie Gilmour is accused of violent disorder during the disturbance in central London. And former Apprentice candidate Kate Walsh has been hired to present Channel 5's new celeb show OKTV. It's after Denise Van Outen pulled out just days before the programme's debut on Monday. That's the latest. I'm Chris Giles.
Bristol Community FM
93.2. BCFM Travel News, in association with the Global Traffic Network, supported by the Highways Agency.
On the northbound M5 going past Bristol, watch out for very slow traffic from before junction 17 at Cribbs Causeway all the way up towards the M4 interchange. And in Salisbury in Wiltshire, the A36 Southampton Road is busy at the College roundabout. And also if you're going west from Salisbury towards Wilton, the A36 is busy between the Park Wall traffic lights and the A30 Wilton roundabout. In Dorset, traffic on the Dorchester bypass is busy going east on the A35 towards the Football Ground roundabout. That's the A354 junction. And on the Devon-Cornwall border, traffic on the westbound side of the A38 Tamar Bridge is heavy going from Devon into Cornwall. Also, if you're going west on the A40 from Gloucestershire into South Wales via Herefordshire, traffic is queuing on the approach to the Monmouth traffic lights. It's slowing down now by the turning for Whitchurch, the B4164 turning. It's taking about half an hour to get from there towards the Monmouth traffic lights. I'm Chris Wood.
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.
Hello Bristol and welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling, and apologies to anyone who's a bit nervous and confused. Red and Griff's Elemental Extravaganza before the news from 4 till 5 has been moved till Monday. But we're still talking to the powers that be here and hope they'll be back on Fridays where they belong soon. Continuing with the politics then, and I'm joined this week by Lib Dem councillor for Eastern, John Keeley, and old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, Bristol City Council prefabs by the Downs in Sneed Park, one of the most sought-after areas in the city, virtually rebuilt, given new roofs, new central heating systems, and then the tenants evicted. That was about 4 years ago, and these prefabs have been slowly falling to bits ever since. We visit the site with council tenants to question the neglect of the housing stock while homeless Bristolians are forced to sleep in car parks. Plus, we continue the series on censorship, documenting MI5's presence at the BBC. What were they up to going through the corporation's personnel files? And can we believe the Director General when he promises us they don't select their staff based on their politics? That's in the second hour after 6 o'clock. Well, on to our review of this week's news in a minute, but here's first our two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 7 Celsius and dry. This weekend, highs of 9 Celsius, dry with some sunshine on Saturday, but a little wet on Sunday. Next week, highs of 11 Celsius, cooler at the beginning of the week, generally cloudy but fairly dry week with some sunshine. Next weekend, that's the 19th and 20th of February, highs of 11, up a little, sunny on Saturday, cloudier on Sunday. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Well, time to introduce this week's guests, and with me is Lib Dem councillor for Easton, John Keeley. Hi, John, and welcome to Drive Time.
Yeah, thanks very much, Tony.
Now, I'm going to ask you exactly the same question as I asked Steve Comer last week. After the betrayal of the students, the 500,000 public sector job losses, and the sell-off of the parks here in Bristol, no one's ever going to vote Lib Dem again, are they?
Well, if you look at the by-elections that have been taking place across the country, since the tuition fee campaign was being run, and obviously we nationally, the opinion polls obviously tend not to read them for obvious reasons. Our by-election results have actually been quite encouraging. So it's not all doom and gloom, but I would say we have got a bit of a hill to climb, and we do run Bristol at the moment, and what we're saying to people is we've got difficult times ahead. You've got an experienced team here. We have delivered for Bristol. The redundancies that the city are going to be around about 100 out of a workforce 9,500. We're protecting frontline services. The other two parties, they ran Bristol into the ground. Labour left us with a massive debt, both locally and nationally, by the way. They've got a habit of doing that. And we're just saying to people, look, okay, promises were made about tuition fees, but there are other issues which are really important about protecting frontline services, elderly people, our education system, and of course, making sure that the council's jobs are there for people. And we've actually delivered on those, in my opinion.
Okay, but this 500,000 threatened public sector job losses is a biggie, isn't it? That's not going to be working in your favour in the months to come, surely.
Well, I can only speak for Bristol, and as far as Bristol City Council is concerned, as I've already said, we have a full-time workforce of 9,500. We've got it down to 160 people's jobs that are actually threatened with redundancy. We're obviously negotiating with those employees at the moment to see if we can reduce that number through voluntary redundancy, redeployment, all the rest of it. So we've really worked very hard. There are some councils in the country, to my mind, seem to have used this opportunity to have a complete clear out and pretend some of it's to do with the recession, and I think that's a shame. But in Bristol we haven't. We're very serious. We believe in our workforce. We've worked very hard to improve the quality of the services. Bristol's moved up the league tables since we've taken over, and all I'll say to people is, judge us on our record in Bristol, not on the coalition. The coalition does not run Bristol. The Liberal Democrats do.
Don't you think there's a danger that what happens in Westminster is going to reflect on the way people vote in May?
Well, of course it will. I mean, every party, where it's ever in government, they all it does affect their vote. I mean, when Labour were running the country, if you looked at by-elections, they were losing by-elections. When you had the war, a lot more people protested about the illegal war in Iraq than they did about tuition fees, by the way, and the government took no notice of that, the Labour government. It's all very fine for them talking about listening to the public now, but they didn't over something that was really important, and lots of people lost their lives over, sort of misleading Parliament, if I can use that term, which the inquiry that's going on at the moment has actually highlighted. Once you get to being in government, the situation changes and the opposition party starts picking up seats and Labour picking up the seats. But in the end, everybody has to make decisions. Even the Liberal Democrats, both locally and nationally, we're now in government in two places, Bristol and in Parliament, and you have to make tough decisions, you have to make the right ones. And in the long term, people look at it and say, yeah, they were right to do what they did. They've got the finances sorted out and we will vote for them. But in the short term, obviously, we have taken a hit. I wouldn't deny that.
Well, what about one of the big stories that's been trundling on for the last year or so, which is the attempted move by the football club out to Ashton Vale, which we had quite a long chat with George Ferguson last week about. The new Sainsbury's in Southville. I mean, what are your thoughts about it, John? Are you pro, against? Are you one of the people on one of these committees that has to actually make the decision? Because I've found that there are quite a lot of councillors I've spoken to who tell me that they just simply can't talk about it.
I think it's a difficult issue. I mean, I would say that the Bristol Evening Post in particular have played a pivotal role here and not a very glorious one. They've bullied people who don't agree with the football club, and I think there has to be questions asked there.
So how has the Evening Post actually bullied people? I mean, they're only a building, surely.
Well, it's the building is actually just the furniture, but you've got an editorial of the paper, and you would expect newspapers to be balanced, and that they would actually look into stories, and they would actually report both sides. I mean, we had the farcical situation of them pushing the council to bid for the World Cup. That's cost the Bristol taxpayers over £200,000, and in the end, thanks to Lord Treisman and others, we've got nowhere near. We've lost that money, and they then try to actually piggyback that onto the stadium and saddle the Bristol City football supporters with a stadium that would be enormous in capacity.
But John, just a minute, let me just backtrack there slightly, because the council didn't have to spend that £200,000, did they?
No, they didn't. I mean, we had a debate, and there was a majority in favour of actually doing it. I mean, I have to say that I was in a minority. I didn't think the World Cup coming to Bristol would have added anything personally, adding onto a stadium, I thought really, linking the two things together was the way of the Evening Post actually trying to promote building the stadium. And the Evening Post is pretty hypocritical, because it spent the last few months attacking the council for building on parkland, and bearing in mind there's going to be more parkland available through the Liberal Democrat policy than there is now, even more parkland available to Bristol.
How is that?
Hold on a second. They haven't actually reported that, by the way. That's been too inconvenient. That's an inconvenient truth.
Would you like to report it now, then, John?
I am reporting it now, because we're actually taking over Purdown. We're buying that site, and that's going to make we're going to have loads of acreage, extra acreage. But the fact is that on one level, they're actually backing local communities, all over the city, sea mills and all the rest of it. Don't get rid of our parks. And the other, they're developing a bill 48 acres of it over in South Bristol. So it's a pretty hypocritical approach. Having said that, the football club does need a new stadium, and I think we should work with them hard to provide them with that stadium. That doesn't stop us asking the questions. Why do they want £6 million of our money for an agreement which basically isn't worth the paper it's written on, in my opinion? And it did come to a committee I sat on, and some of the things that were being suggested that we would get for our £6 million, quite frankly, they ought to have been doing anyway. And if we're going to have some added value to the stadium, then really what the people of Bristol would like to see, I know, would be an arena for pop concerts and music concerts to get the top stars to come here. And that would generate a lot of jobs and a lot of excitement, of course. And we also need an exhibition centre. We do not have one at the moment. People are driving to Birmingham or to London, and I think we're a regional capital, we should have those things. And if the stadium could actually help us provide those, they would be good. But the other things they're talking about providing, the community work, outreach work, really, as somebody who's been involved with Bristol Rovers Football Club, we used to have it in our ward, they're doing all this stuff, and I'm sure the city are as well, Bristol City are as well. And to be giving them, cash in kind of £6 million to somebody who actually doesn't pay a penny of tax in this country, lives in the Channel Islands, I think it's, personally, there are questions there.
Now, what about the Sainsbury's, though? Because this is the one that's coming up in March, and we're in the bizarre situation where Bristol City Football Club may be mandated to sell their existing stadium to Sainsbury's for a superstore without actually having somewhere already sorted out with planning permission and nowhere to go. They'll be homeless.
Well, it'll be like Bristol Rovers then. A lot of us actually feel that, the other sporting organisations within the city, the rugby, the cricket and Bristol Rovers, we're not given the same kind of support, from the council in the past. I mean, obviously it was a Labour council then, this is Lib Dem one now, so I hope we would give them, all of them, better support. I mean, a lot of us are very keen on Bristol Rovers Football Club, for example, and like to see it here, but it was moved out to Twerton. It wasn't even playing in Bristol and was treated really shabbily by, by the city council in those days. But I think the fans really should be asking lots of questions of this. Why is this deal being put in this way? I mean, is it because they want to put a gun to the council's head, or is it because they have to move? They need to be really, really careful, to saddle themselves in the future, because a lot of these millionaires, they get involved in football clubs all over the country, and as soon as they get bored with it, they pull out and they leave clubs with lots of debts. I'm not saying it's going to happen here, but they need to be really asking very searching questions about the finances of this deal and any other deal. As far as the Sainsbury's is concerned, I mean, I'm not on the planning committee, but I do not like the idea of actually ruining North Street, which is a really wonderful area of Bristol now, with a variety of mixture of shops, just for another supermarket. We've got plenty of those already.
Well, why do you think it's going to ruin North Street? Sure, it's going to bring even more people to that part of the city.
Well, the evidence is, you know, where you build superstores, they tend to have, they attract a certain type of customer. They then gridlock the streets. There's actually the public transport system around there is not absolutely brilliant. And one of the big arguments that was planning, what was turned down originally, was that the planning committee at the time were not convinced that their travel to store plan, or whatever they call these things, was actually robust enough. So that's one of the reasons why they turned it, well, they turned it down. But, you know, a lot of traders are concerned. I mean, you had George Ferguson here. He's quite vocal about superstores. We need to have a much more balance in our high street these days. We've destroyed them over the last 20 and 30 years. And now they're beginning to come back with places like, you know, Church Road, Gloucester Road, you know, and North Street's really wonderful. And it would be a real shame, you know, to throw that out without actually really looking in detail at it. You know, and I don't see there's much need for another superstore. We've got loads of them already. There's an Asda quite close by and, you know, fair enough.
Now, old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is with me too. Hi, Martin.
Hello.
And the leader of the opposition, David Miliband, was in Bristol today. Now, did the party apparatchiks let you speak to him?
He was actually Ed Miliband, by the way.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, did I say David? I'm
David
sorry.
David is the
Ed,
one
yeah.
who lost the election, Tony.
Yeah, so did you get to speak
to
him?
One lost.
It's a matter of opinion. Yeah, no, I couldn't get to speak to him because these people, they're on very tight schedules and I had to be here for your show, Tony, so I
what
had
was
to
he
rush back.
What was Ed actually here to do then?
He's doing a sort of meet. There's an audience of people who have been... They're an invited audience, but they were selected at random, I was assured. It's basically a question and answer session, a sort of meet the people thing, which Nick Clegg did a very similar event, which I went to last year.
Okay, and so how did it go?
Well, I was only there for 2 minutes, Tony. Otherwise, I wouldn't be here now.
2 minutes.
I did record what Ed said. I mean, what was interesting is he only spoke for 2 minutes and then he opened it up for questions. So I got all of his initial speech, which is about 2 minutes, and then it was opened up for questions, and I had to leave because I had to be here.
Okay. Well, let's have a little listen now to what Ed had to say.
I want to raise an issue which I think is a very, very big issue for our society, which is what the chances of the next generation are going to be in our country. If one of the things that worries me most, and I think it should be a worry not just the young people, but their parents, their grandparents, indeed all of us, is if you look at some of the changes that are being made, they come on top of already very difficult prospects for many young people in this country. When you think about the jobs that are available, the housing market, that's even before you get to issues like climate change. I think about my own kids, both of whom are under two now. I think quite a lot about what are the prospects for the world we're going to be passing on to them. And then you've got a whole series of other changes being made by the government, from the end of the Child Trust Fund, to threats to Sure Start in certain areas, the children's centres, and then the changes to university fees, educational maintenance allowances, and so on. So one question, one issue I think for us to focus on is how do we... And how does my generation deliver a better deal for the next generation rather than a worse deal, which I fear is the direction in which we are currently headed. The second thing I just want to say about the cuts and about some of the changes that are being made is I think one of the things that we didn't do enough of in government is understand the world that mattered to people beyond the bottom line. Not just the pound in their pocket, but also the local post office, the local high street, the character of their neighbourhood and their community. There's no good reason why we should raise this issue, which I think is a very, very big issue.
Okay, well, that was Martin's couple of minutes with Ed Miliband earlier on. Martin, it's a bit rich, isn't it, for Ed to be now saying, well, we didn't quite get this right. And what he's doing really is trying to wriggle out of the fact that, to a large extent, the situation we're in now is the responsibility of this new Labour administration that's been in power with Tony Blair and Gordon Brown since 1997.
Well, I think that's right. And what happens when you lose an election, as we did, is that you've got to then have a rethink about why people didn't like what you were saying. And that's what happens. That's what always happens. I mean, that's what happens when the Conservatives lose elections or the Liberal Party lose elections. You go away, you have a word with yourself and decide what is it we were doing wrong. Because obviously you're doing something wrong because you lost. And I think what Ed Miliband represents is a bit of a gamble for the party because he wasn't the obvious choice. And I think the party activists in particular felt that, and the trade union activists, because we all voted individually as well, felt they wanted to actually go for somebody who didn't have too much baggage in terms of connection with the previous regime. Now, in some ways, that might be regarded as an error. I heard John saying earlier that David should have won, and some people might say that. But I think that the party has decided to go for a slightly more radical approach rather than playing safe. And we'll see whether that pays off in terms of elections. But I mean, that's a done deal now. That's the decision, and that's what people are going to support.
Now, John, what about this whole bit? I mean, what Ed is saying there is what he's doing is he's trying to woo some of these Liberal voters, people that left the Labour Party at the last general election and voted for your party, and are trying to get them back again. And he's citing some of the real serious problems facing young people now: housing, jobs, and education, to name but three. So, how is the Liberal Party going to actually woo young voters? It's a sort of tug of war, really, between your party and Ed Miliband to actually come back, particularly with these youngsters. The problem being that they were promised this whole promise, which was made before the election by the Lib Dems, of keeping tuition fees level or even getting rid of them altogether. And now we're being told they're going up to anything up to £9,000 a go. This is really a betrayal of youngsters. So you've got a lot of work to do to get them back on side, haven't you?
Well, I think the problem really about the tuition fees debate was that the party didn't actually, put forward the policy, properly in the first place. And I mean, I did actually, contact, Nick Clegg and others and say, look, you really ought to be articulating what it is your policy is going to be and how it's going to affect people. But they didn't listen to me, as they probably don't listen to others as well. They're probably getting thousands of these things. And I think that, I mean, Nick Clegg's now going around the country now trying to explain it, in reverse. And I think he's got a bit of a difficult job on his hands. Because if you look at the policy, I mean, essentially what was happening under Labour was that, lots of people were going to university from middle-class families and above. And all the general taxpayers, people, hospital porters on £12,000 a year, were paying part of their tax to educate the rich, having spent billions of pounds on education in this country, there is still a situation where people are leaving school without a proper education. And Ed Miliband, I mean, an absolute source to talk about families and homes. As I said, you said it yourself, after 13 years, over a million families without a decent roof over their heads on how council house waiting lists. Why were they on those council house waiting lists? Because not one council house was built in the 13 years they're in office. Quite and they right. made everything else unaffordable. You have 40 odd thousand pounds to get a mortgage, and most people just could not afford it. They priced them out of the market, and they sat up there in their ivory tower in London, completely ignoring it. And now all of a sudden, they're surprised to learn that there's a real life out there. And this is the problem with Parliament, by the way, and it's a problem with most parties, not just Labour, that we are represented by an elite who have no real experience. The days of the dockers and the shop workers are sadly in the main are over, and we need to try and get a much more representative democracy. Maybe the Egyptians could show us the way. But that is the problem. And Ed Miliband can talk about progressive politics all he likes, but over the last 3-4 weeks, under his leadership, the dinosaurs in the House of Lords have blocked electoral reform, which is very close to a lot of Liberal Democrats' hearts. We're Liberal Democrats, but not Liberals. But we are Liberals at heart, if you like. And they've blocked that. If he had any real authority as a leader, he ought to be saying to these dinosaurs, like Prescott and co, now come on, I'm in favour of AV. I don't want you to filibuster this. Yes, they've got to moan about their constituencies not being the right size, but that's quite outrageous. I think they wanted a inbuilt advantage.
It's not, John, it's not about the constituencies not being the right size. What they've done is they've said you can have this alternative vote system, which is most people would say a much better system of proportional proportional representation. But if you're going to have it, you've also got to take a big reduction in the number of MPs. This is where the filibustering's coming in, surely. Yeah. Is they're saying you can only have this if you have this too. Why can't they have the two separate?
Well, I have to say that it's actually pretty rich, Tony, to actually say that you're going to lose 500,000 public sector workers, but Prescott and his buddies in the House of Commons and the House of Lords will filibuster to keep an extra 60 MPs and Lords actually in jobs. Everybody else is taking a hit. People are losing their jobs because of the mismanagement of our economy under Prescott and Miliband and the rest of them. And then when we're saying, well, hold on a second, you might have to reduce the amount of representation in the House of Commons all of a sudden is far too precious. We've got to keep the amount of MPs all earning, you know, lashing great salaries, expenses, all going on speaking tours, all the rest of it. Got plenty of time to do lots of other things, write books, you know, and be on directors and boards, by the way, while the rest of us are killing ourselves, you know, being taxed to the hill, you know. So you know, if Miliband really is a progressive, and I don't, it's all talk, and he was elected by the unions, the Labour membership actually a majority voted for the other Miliband, you know.
So why did Nick Clegg agree to all this then? Because you would have thought if he really was serious about AV, he would have said, no, you're not going to be able to, you're not going to make sure that the AV discussion and the AV discussion is you can only have AV if you're going to reduce the MPs by 60. That's then surely this is just weakness in your party and weakness in your leader and a lack of democracy in the Lib Dems.
Well, I think this was bringing together two different policies. Remember, we're actually in a coalition with another party which is larger than ours, and what they said was for us to have AV, I think we should have negotiated to have proportional representation, not AV, and we should have said in the agreement, the coalition agreement at the start, was this is the weakness. The weakness isn't this policy. The weakness is not saying we are not going to coalition with you unless it's on the statute book. Having a referendum on it is a disaster for me, particularly when the party's at 10% in the polls. And so we've got to hope that the public will look beyond that and say, look, you know, this is a really important change to our democratic process. Having said that, that's where we are at the moment. And it's very difficult to argue, let's have unequal constituencies, you know, where you've got, somebody's got 100,000 voters, somebody's only got 50 or 60. And that's supposed to be fair, particularly as it actually benefits one party. The party that's doing all the moaning, by the way, in Parliament. So it's quite a disingenuous campaign, this. And to see, as I said, Prescott and all these old dinosaurs running about, just remind you more, you know, why it's good they're out of office, thank God. And they're rather old-fashioned ideas. They want to protect the mother of parliaments, which is now so out of date. And the only party, the only parliament in the world that operates a first-past-the-post system now, in no modernised system, you know, blocking other parties, the Green parties, other people from having fair representation in Parliament, and not having equal constituencies. It's an absolute farce, it is, really.
Martin, what's your thoughts about the this discussion that's been filibustered in the House of Lords about linking the new voting system to getting rid of 60 MPs?
Well, I mean, I think the key to this is that the Conservatives were only persuaded to have a referendum on AV if they got what they wanted, which was to redraw the constituencies. And I'm in favour of equal constituencies as well. And we had a boundary commission which over years kept shifting boundaries through a negotiated process to make sure that they were. But that was a kind of independent process. The boundary commission was not politicised, although the changes, you know, for example, in Bristol West, Eastern was moved from one constituency to another, and there was an ongoing process of doing this. One of the problems we've got is that we know that the electoral register is not complete, and particularly in inner city wards like yours, John, you'll know that lots of people aren't registered. And if we redraw the boundaries on the basis of the existing electoral register, that will give an advantage to the more privileged in the society, in the community. They will be overrepresented. Now, these things are so important that fairness is very important in every aspect of running elections, isn't it? And personally, of course, I'm in favour of PR, not just AV. And I agree with you that the Liberals were rather foolish to go into a coalition with the Conservatives without getting that under their belt.
That's absolutely right, yeah.
I think there's a room for building a bridge here, because I see Miliband very clearly believes in changing the electoral system, and that was one of the things that made me vote for him in the internal Labour Party election, because I saw the others were not prepared to change it. And I think the changing of the electoral system is key, because then we'll find that we get a wider selection of voices, which changes the debate, which then allows more serious discussion to take place. At the moment, everything is funneled into a narrow funnel by the electoral system, and we actually need to broaden the debate, so that, because we've got lots of very hard choices ahead, and we need to hear a plethora of voices.
Okay, and one of the main stories this week we're going to plunge into now is Project Merlin, George Osborne and Ed Balzer. We're going to hear in a moment discussing this new deal which has been done between the City of London and George Osborne and the Treasury. So now let's have a listen to Faisal Islam, and he's just going to introduce this report, and then we'll hear from George Osborne and Ed Balls in the Commons on Project Merlin.
The banks will lend more money, especially to small businesses, pay more taxes, pay less bonuses, be more transparent about the bonuses they do pay, and make a greater contribution to our regional economy and society.
City Pay is the other key element of this deal, and almost every banker, even at the bailed out banks, can conceal their winnings from public view. The Big Four have confirmed that this year's bonus pot will be smaller than last year, but that's down to lower profits. They'll also reveal the five highest paid staff on top of their board of directors. So there will be more disclosure here than abroad, but far less than had been planned by the previous government. And specifically, we won't be told if bailed out RBS is creating the 200 bonus millionaires that is widely suspected.
Well, the critics are saying this is more of a surrender than a peace treaty.
The government is demanding of local authorities they publish the salaries of anyone in local government earning over £58,200. But he's allowing a taxpayer-owned bank and publicly quoted companies in the financial sector to continue to pay staff members millions of pounds in pay and bonuses with no transparency at all.
The hope in the city and in the Treasury is that they can now draw a line under 2 years of bank bashing that followed, perhaps understandably, the financial crisis, the move to recovery rather than retribution. But it's unclear that the public feels the same, and there's another battle to fight over the structure of the banking industry and whether or not it should be broken up. That's a decision for an independent commission on banking that will report later this year.
Now, that was Faisal Islam discussing Project Merlin, which was announced this week in the House of Commons by George Osborne, the results of negotiations between the Treasury and the banks over disclosure, mainly, of and on bonuses. What are your thoughts then, John, on what's been announced this week? Do you think it's enough?
No, I don't. I really, you know, if somebody in the private sector, you know, went to their bosses and said, look, I've actually lost the firm several billion pounds, but I noticed in my pay packet I didn't get a bonus for this year, I think most of them say, well, you know, never mind a bonus, here's the door. You know, it's an absolute outrage that ordinary people have lost their jobs. You know, we've lost, you know, very well-known high street names have disappeared completely. You know, people are facing, you know, redundancy. Other people have actually had their pay cut in their workforce, and and there's a lot of worry and concern out there. And now we have the people who've caused the problem, you know, all acting as though nothing's happened. The thing that worries me the most about all this is it seems to be returning to business as usual. And I just do not think, you know, that they should be paid these bonuses. I don't think enough has been done.
Well, one of the nationalised, if you can call it that, banks, certainly majority owned by the public now, RBS, we're talking about 200 this year, and this is going to be announced next week, although we're not going to know necessarily how much these people are paid. 200 bonus millionaires. Employees of RBS. I mean, this is our money.
Well, it's our money. I suppose the counter argument that will be put forward by George Osborne and maybe even Vince Cable is, you know, obviously these banks owe us a lot of money, billions of pounds, and the more successful they can be and they're attracting the top people to come and work for them, then they'll be able to pay this money back early. And of course, the more money we get in the kitty, then obviously we can start spending again on things that really matter to us. But I just don't think at the moment it wears. I think we were told by the coalition government we're all in this together, but some people are in it more than others, I'm afraid. And so sorry, it doesn't wash. If these people had any decency about them, they would say, no, we won't take the money until the country is out of, you know, its critical financial problems. And, you know, we are shoulder to shoulder with council workers, health workers, and people in the manufacturing and shops who've lost their jobs. And we recognise that, and we will do something about it. We'll even donate our money if necessary, if there's no way of getting out of these agreements. But no, it's outrageous.
Well, obviously, I agree with that, and I'm very glad to hear John say it. Because obviously, willy-nilly, it's the Liberal Democrat Conservative Coalition which will run the country for the interim. And so I would like to see them do the right things. And I'm glad to hear what he's just said. I suspect we'd have had a similar argument if the Labour Party had won the election, because they probably would have bottled it as well, as you well know. The problem we've got is that the political process in the US and Britain has been bought by the financial oligarchy. And that's a real problem. If anybody involved in politics knows that politicians need money for leaflets, for telephone calls, for everything, and where do you go for money? Oh, you go to the people with the money. And then, of course, they want a pound of flesh for that money. And it's becoming increasingly apparent to people that it doesn't matter who you vote for, the bankers always win. And that is actually very bad for democracy, because a lot of people are going to conclude, especially if the economy crashes as it might, that democracy itself has failed. And that's a real problem.
Now, David Cameron was in Bavaria last weekend at a security conference, but he decided not to talk necessarily about security, but about multiculturalism. So let's have a listen to what he had to say.
Under the doctrine of state multiculturalism, we've encouraged different cultures to live separate lives apart from each other and apart from the mainstream. We need to think much harder about who it's in the public interest to work with. Some organisations that seek to present themselves as a gateway to the Muslim community are showered with public money, despite doing little to combat extremism.
Don't patronise me by saying we have showered you with money. That money didn't come from your own pocket. That came from the taxpayers' money, rightly and deservedly by those voluntary organisations who are providing good services. Extremist organisations are an enemy to everybody. But to deal with it and to sort them out and to challenge them, Mr. Cameron doesn't need to throw the baby with the bathwater.
Well, the obvious implication here, John Keeley, Lib Dem councillor, is that we've got a problem with the with multiculturalism, and this is interfacing somehow with security issues. Now, do you think this is an appropriate place to be talking about multiculturalism at the annual big European Security Conference in Bavaria, in Munich?
Well, I think there's a lot of historical sort of aspects to that as well, isn't there? No, I don't think it was actually the most wisest place to make those comments, bearing in mind that the conference was about something else. And also the timing, there was something going on the same day, you know, with, you know, sort of racist-type marches going on in other parts of the country as well, which could fan the flames. If your prime minister, you've got to be really, really careful. You know, you're treading a fine line. And, you know, what might seem, you know, like foreign land from an Oxfordshire village, you know, where David Cameron spends most of his time, and where the Conservatives seem to, you know, they seem to be sort of harking back to a country, England, if you like, that no longer really exists. I mean, they need to get out a bit more and see the real world. I mean, it's absolute nonsense. We live in a multicultural world, not just a multicultural society in Britain. I mean, you know, everybody now, wherever you go in the world, rely on other people, the skills, the cultural things they bring, and the richness they bring to a society. And really, David Cameron ought to be looking at the causes of why people feel aggrieved, as opposed to sort of like bringing down the heavy hand of the state, which is what the previous prime minister and party did, and look at, you know, why do people feel, you know, that they're not connected to this society when they see, you know, the democratic process ignored, you know, with troops being sent to other countries, their religions being vilified, and people losing their lives and their liberty, and they think, well, you know, it seems to be okay to do it to them, but you know, there are causes to these things, and you know, you really, you know, once you shake the genie in the bottle, you know, you've got to be really, really careful that you don't let it out. And I'm afraid with this kind of stuff, they have let the genie out of the bottle a little bit, and you know, that speech was really unhelpful, I'm afraid, and nonsense as well.
But your party is connected at the hip to at Westminster anyway, to David Cameron, and I saw on Question Time last night that the English Defence League and some of the far right parties in other parts of Europe were slapping Cameron on the back.
Well, it's always a difficulty. I mean, you know, we're in a partnership, a coalition with another party to actually run the country, to help out, particularly with the economic crisis that we've inherited. But we are not actually in coalition with them for some of their more extreme views that they hold on other things in life, and the fact that they support millionaires, and they seem to have this kind of Little Englander approach, Eurosceptic kind of view of the world. We do not. We are a Euro-enthusiastic party, you know. And I think it's helpful to Parliament to have a situation where no party has an overall majority, and these parties are now being confronted about some of these things. But no, we're not joined at the hip with them over these kinds of comments. You know, these comments are insensitive, they're not true. You know, they do not have real experience what goes on in multicultural society. As I said, they all in Berber jackets, 4x4s in you know, nice little Oxfordshire country villages. It's all very posh and very nice for them, but sadly there's a real world out there that David Cameron and others need to actually get more of a grip on.
Now I'm joined by Marina Morris. Hi, Marina. And hello. What have you got for us this week?
Hello. Public libraries. In its 2011-12 saving plans, Bristol City Council is planning to cut £200,000, or about 3% of the library's budget, to be provided by more flexible working, self-service, and the flexible use of buildings. This is in addition to a cut of £90,000, or around 14% of the library book fund. No libraries funded by Bristol City Council are currently identified at a risk of closure. Nationally, at least, for Hungary's 85 libraries, 426 buildings and 59 mobiles are currently under threat or have recently closed. But this number is growing as more councils are announcing and publishing saving plans. According to the Brian Hall, president of the Chartered Institute of Library Professionals, public libraries are part of England's national heritage, bequeathed to us by the Victorians, and ours must not to be the generation that destroys this heritage. The Minister for Libraries at Wasey has said that he will not legally get involved to stop closures as he can under the 1964 Libraries and Museums Act until after he has consulted these councils. The law clearly says that libraries should be comprehensive and efficient for those who wish to use them. Central government, however, seems keen to distance itself from the pain of local government spending cuts. As a possible alternative, in a series of YouTube videos, Tim Coates, a former head of Waterstones, has explained how millions are being wasted on so-called back-office library cost. Public libraries are not a new idea. Romans made scrolls in dry rooms available to patrons of the baths and tried with some success to establish libraries within the empire. Naturally, only those few that could afford an education would be able to use a library. In Bristol, an early library that allowed access to the public was the Libraries of Calendars, or Calendarius, a brotherhood or clergy attached to the Church of All Saints. Records show that in 1464, provisions was made for a library to be built. The English merchant William Caxton set up the first printing press in England in 1476. One of the first town's libraries in the country was opened in Bristol in 1615. The Public Libraries Act 1850 first gave local boroughs the power to establish free public libraries. The 4,540 public libraries that existed in the United Kingdom in 2010 can trace their origins back to this act. More than 10% of these could soon disappear.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Marina. And Marina's been out on the streets this week to find out what you think of reductions in Bristol's library service, which have just been announced, both announced and planned for the future. Now we have the internet. Are libraries redundant?
Nationally, 485 libraries have recently closed or are threatened with closure. Is this a mistake? And who's harmed by closing libraries?
Yes, I think it's a mistake. Who would be harmed would be like children, pensioners, anybody in search of learning or knowledge.
I think having a library, it's part of the foundation of our educational society, the educational system. Our education is built on the availability of information. So if they were to close libraries, I'm sure there would be a large part of the community that would be prevented from gaining the information they need, because although majority of us use the internet to collect our information, I'm sure there's still a large amount of people who don't have access to the internet. Libraries are there to help that, and the impacts are, you know, far wider than I think most people really understand. So closing libraries without real much forethought is, you know, I think is really a mistake.
That's a destruction of a culture, I believe. Not only a mistake, but a destruction of a culture. I would say there are lots of people who are benefiting from these facilities. They should be kept for sure.
I don't think it's a mistake. You just buy books or go on eBay and buy books.
I think it could be a mistake for the older people who don't necessarily have online access, or they're not as good with the online world. But I think, to be honest, a lot of younger people wouldn't think of going to a library in the first place.
Well, I suppose it is a bad thing, but most times children and probably older people that might feel that they can use the library to pass the time away. So, I mean, I don't use the library that much anyway. I suppose kids and older people would.
How often and why do you use libraries?
At least once a week. I'd go there to read the daily papers. Yeah, I'd lose that access. Not everybody has access to the internet. People prefer books. They're part of our culture and history. In the past, politicians didn't want us to have libraries. So I think they're an important part of our culture. They need to be kept. If they need to adapt to the times and changing with sort of like internet connection, computers, fine, but they're a place where everybody can go and learn and enjoy. They're very, very important to us.
Not any longer, but when I was young, I used to spend a lot of time in libraries. There were no computers, but in those days, my majority of my time is spent on working in offices. So if I had time, I would definitely.
I buy books. I don't like giving them back.
I used to use them quite regularly, but now I've got the internet. Get all the information I need from there, but I used it for information, possibly. In the past.
Can volunteers offer the same standard of service?
I don't think that is useful in the long run. It's because you're dependent on volunteers. And sometimes if you don't have enough volunteers or people don't want to do it, maybe lose access to the spaces which they are stored. I understand the feelings and the emotion that goes into it and that it must be saved. You either have everybody involved and taking turns do their share or you just have the burden put on a few specialist people. I'd be against volunteers.
Charities are voluntary organisations, and I don't think the quality of service you get from a charity is any less. So a quality service you'd get from a library, I don't believe that would be any less either. As long as it's well organised, which most charities are, and this would mostly run like a charity, then why should there be a degradation in service at all? It shouldn't change anything at all, really.
They can achieve the same quality, maybe even better, but a state's job, I believe, is to build up the infrastructure for its people. What's the state going to do then? We can manage with volunteers everything, the government itself as well.
If people are that passionate about the job, then yeah. If you just employ anyone, then they won't do it. But if someone genuinely loves the job, then yeah, why not?
No, I don't at all. I think it's a nice idea, but in reality, if these things aren't taken seriously, they're not done properly, and you can't expect a volunteer to provide the same service.
Of course, it could still be the same quality, but obviously it's not so it's good to have them doing it. Obviously, you can have full-time staff and volunteers would probably be better than just volunteer staff.
Is there an alternative to using libraries in the future?
The obvious answer would be like the internet, but I would be sceptical of that, saying that. One, because it's an electronic medium, and with no electricity, you lose that. Whereas books are in a physical form, and they exist.
That's Marina Morris's Vox Pop this week, all about libraries. Now, John, it's something quite important to many, many people. And of course, we just heard there about the possibility of the internet taking over from libraries. It's not really going to happen, is it? Because the internet it gives you access to information, but you don't have that hard and fast thing. Actually have a book in your hand.
No, I think there is something really rather nice about having a book in your hand, and I don't like looking at a screen to read something for a long period. I think it's very good for your eyes. But I mean, the fact is that the libraries themselves can actually provide you with the internet, so having a library in the community is really important for that. I mean, the gentleman on there was saying that he goes in to read newspapers. Other people go in there to use photocopying facilities, and others go in there obviously to surf the net.
So what's the state of play in Bristol with our libraries? Because there are some that are sort of underused. People will say they're underused, and therefore, what's the point in paying for them?
Well, we have got a difficulty because we have a number of libraries which were built really when an estate was built. So you've got some, I won't name the areas to sort of alarm anybody, but you've got some that were built. There was obviously an estate, and the estate actually had a heart, and the library was part of the estate. And you've got these libraries all over Bristol. They're all a lot of them are 1930s to 1950s. They're not very easy to convert. They're quite actually limited in terms of space, so they're not ideal. Having said that, there is no plans to close any Bristol library. In fact, we opened a brand new one last year at Whitchurch, next to the Asda, which has got a big footfall, and people in that part of Bristol did not have a library. They've been promised for 30 years. I'm glad the Lib Dems, by the way, actually delivered them the library. And of course, the Trinity Library down here in Easton, which is important to us and me as a local councillor, is being closed and being moved to a new M32 kind of learning and other type of building. So it won't just be a library, and I think that's the key, really. That's the way for the future, is to look at providing library within a framework of other services.
Well, for people that use the internet most of the time or other forms of communication and hardly ever visit the libraries, is there any actual reason to even pop in at all?
Well, if they don't want to, no, nobody's going to force them, you know, Tony. But
no, but what's in there for people? This is what I'm saying. Well, for example, it could be a place to give out all sorts of information about what's available, council services
well,
around,
it does,
and that kind of thing.
And that's exactly what happens now under our administration. That's exactly what we've done. We're developing the fact that people pay their bills there. They can get advice. They can go and meet council officers there. You know, and so the service isn't just about providing people with books. Well, that's a really important part of it because people are researching things, and librarians can actually provide them with a starting point for a look for their search. So it isn't just about books. But in the end, culture and taste has changed. You can't deny that footfall, the amount of customers going through the door, has declined over years. The internet, DVDs, television, and all these things have actually played their part.
But what's
and what the library's got to do is really got to make sure it's actually relevant to today, really, and that's what it's doing.
But as Marina's just said, you're cutting in Bristol nearly £100,000, which is what, 15% roughly of the library book fund.
We're cutting £200,000 is what she said in the report, which I think is actually the figure. But in the end, we've got to make £38,000 worth of savings, to the council's budget. You've got to look at do you take that from social services or from vulnerable sort of residents, or do you take it from the others? Unfortunately, the kind of cultural things are always the things that hit the most. But as I said, we're not cutting a library, we're actually opening new ones.
Well, let's just make this clear, because it's £200,000 from the library's budget and £90,000 from the book fund.
Right, yeah. But the thing is, what we're doing with books is that we're working with other councils now. We're creating a kind of a purchasing consortium, so we're buying in bulk now, where in the old days the council would just buy the books itself. It's now working in partnership with others to buy services, and a lot of this is being done much more now. And of course, a lot of those will go self-service, which will reduce the amount of staff in the libraries.
But cutting the actual money that's being spent on books is surely is counterproductive, John, because you're going to find that there's less reason for people to come in there to look at the newer books that have just been published.
Well, as I said, you've got to make decisions, and not all of them are easy ones. We'd rather be spending more money on books and other services in the library, but sadly that isn't the case. We've got to cut our cloth accordingly, and if we don't cut the library service, a little bit, which we're doing here, then we'd have to cut something else which may impact on people generally. And, social policy is really important to Liberal Democrats, and ensuring that people are getting their meal service, that housing advice and all the rest of it, things are being provided in the community for people. They are really important. Libraries, yes, it's taking a reduction, but we are building new libraries and refurbishing the service, and I think we're making it fit for the 21st century as much as we can with the resources available.
Martin, you a library user?
Yes, I am. I use the library very frequently. I think the main problem we've got here is the whole philosophy of cutting things because we've got no money. I understand Bristol City Council, whoever was running it, would be in a difficult position because the standard spending assessment and so on is decided elsewhere. I think if the economy goes down the drain this year, as I suspect it might, and the deficit is bigger by the end of the year, people are going to realise that this whole philosophy of cutting to save money isn't actually going to make sense. And I think people will gradually begin to realise you can't cut your way out of a depression.
Do you want to answer that one, John? Because this is rather worrying, isn't it? We've seen the last figures of actually saying, well, even though the recession was officially over, we're now back into recession again, and we're having negative growth now.
Well, you can't go on with spending £120 million a day on interest and not providing one service and say, oh no, we will do nothing about it, but a hard ahead. And that's what Labour did actually when they were in power for the last 13 years. Spent, maxed out on the credit card, and so future generations are going to have to pay for it. And, every time Labour in office, whether it's locally at Bristol or nationally, they leave the country in a debt. They've done it exactly the same this time as they did last time. But Liberal Democrat leaders, I have to say, agree with Martin on one thing. Liberal Democrat leaders have actually written to the government, to Nick Clegg and all the others, to say that the cuts are too deep and that they should actually have a rethink. We do think there should be reductions. We understand they're a problem, but they are going too far too fast.
Well, I agree that they're going too far too fast, and that's where the debate is now for serious people. But I suspect once you get into a crash, John, and you have crashed, then it's not a question of cutting public expenditure. You've got to then start talking about expanding expenditure in order to get people back to work, and then you've got to pay for that, which means raising taxes on the kind of people we were criticising, both of us, earlier, the bankers who are walking away with the loot.
Maybe Ed Balls and Gordon Brown ought to spend a bit more time actually looking at the figures when they're in charge, as opposed to leaving other people to tear up their mess afterwards.
OK, on to Egypt now. now, and the big news just been announced of the resignation of Hosni Mubarak, the Egyptian president. And before we have a listen to this next report, can I just have your reaction first, John, as to what you think, how you think things have been going in Egypt? And I mean, we obviously have people out on the streets, and finally, it looks like they've got what they want. Is that right? Is that good?
Well, I think, you know, anything that's going to lead to a democratic country for the people of Egypt is a good thing. I mean, it is very unhealthy to have, you know, a man in power for 30 years with no obvious, democracy or alternative political parties to run the country available. They've all been suppressed in one way or another. A very large military presence. It's all a big worry. And so, you know, from one level, I'm very... I'm pleased and delighted for the people of Egypt that their voices have been heard. My only worry, of course, is that when you have a one-party state, you have a vacuum. And at the moment, you know, who's going to fill that vacuum? Will the army fill that vacuum? Or, you know, because obviously the opposition parties are not... There's no obvious alternative to the Mubarak regime at the moment.
Well, before we have a go...
It could be very, very dangerous, actually. It could be very, very dangerous, you know, for the future of the country. But in principle, democracy is a good thing, and let's hope they get it.
Before we have a go at answering those questions, Asma Mahfouz and the YouTube video that helped spark the Egyptian uprising. Well, 3 weeks ago today, 26-year-old Egyptian activist Asma Mahfouz posted a video online urging people to protest the corrupt government of Hosni Mubarak by rallying in Tahrir Square on January the 25th. Her moving call ultimately helped inspire Egypt's uprising. "I'm a girl," she says. "I'm going down to Tahrir Square and I will stand alone. I'll hold up a banner. Perhaps people will show some honour," Mahfouz said. "I don't think you can be safe anymore. None of us are. Come down with us and demand your rights, my rights, your family's rights. I'm going down on January the 25th and will say no to corruption, no to this regime." So let's have a little listen now to Asma Mahfouz.
"Four Egyptians have set themselves on fire to protest humiliation and hunger and poverty and degradation they had to live with for 30 years. Four Egyptians have set themselves on fire thinking maybe we can have a revolution like Tunisia. Maybe we can have freedom, justice, honor, and human dignity. Today, one of these four has died, and I saw people commenting and saying that he committed a sin and killed himself for nothing. People have some shame. I posted that I, a girl, am going down to Tahrir Square and I will stand alone. And I'll hold up a banner. Perhaps people will show some honor. I even wrote my number so maybe people will come down with me. No one came except three guys and three armored cars of riot police, and tens of hired thugs and officers came to terrorize us. They shoved us roughly away from the people. But as soon as we were alone with them, they started to talk to us."
That's a quite moving video on YouTube, which was shared all around the internet in Egypt, which many people are saying led to these demonstrations. Martin, what do you make of the beginning and the potential end of this revolution in Egypt?
Well, obviously everybody's been following this, so I'll try and give people some information that they probably haven't got, which is that another spark for the beginning of these demonstrations is that there was a horrific bomb attack on the Coptic Cathedral in Alexandria on New Year's Eve, which killed 24 people and injured a lot more. It was blamed by the government on Islamic extremists from Gaza. But on Tuesday this week, or Wednesday this week, the interior minister of the time, a certain Al-Arabi, has been called in by the prosecutor's office in Egypt and formally charged with the bombing. When this bombing took place, the government was trying to suggest it was Islamists that had carried it out, that therefore we need to carry on having a strong government to keep these terrorists under control. But it turns out, in actual fact, that they were the terrorists, or that's what it's looking like. What was very interesting is on Christmas, on Coptic Christmas, which is January the 7th, the Copts, the Christians, went to their churches fearing a further attack. And far from getting a further attack, hundreds of thousands of Muslims turned up to the Christian services to show their solidarity with their Christian fellow citizens. And that was another big effect of this crisis, which has been hidden thus far. But what's fascinating is that this guy has now been charged. The two guys who actually did the bombing were in prison, and they were released as part of this let's get some thugs to attack Tahrir Square. They went straight to the British Embassy, I understand, and the British Embassy passed them to the prosecutor's office. But can you see what's happening here? The regime is that wicked that it kills innocent people in order to create sectarian tension and then claim that it's going to be squashing Islamist extremism. And a lot of Islamist extremism is, in fact, the security services in Egypt and elsewhere.
OK, so where's it going then, Martin? What do you think now we've had the Mubarak's resignation today?
Well, it's hard. It's easy for us to sit here and speculate. I mean, what could happen, what very, very easily could happen, is there could be a bloodbath. Both this Friday and last Friday, I was looking at it and hoping and praying that nothing was going to happen. It hasn't happened this afternoon, thankfully, but the danger is always there because this kind of regime finds it very difficult to give up power easily. Don't forget the Israelis are backing them to the hilt. The Americans may be wobbling, but I'm quite sure the Israelis aren't. And what are these guys going to do if you have a democracy? Well, they're going to be kicked out. Some of them are probably going to be put in prison. They'll have all their wealth taken off them. That makes it very hard for them to back down.
John. John, what are your thoughts on what's been going on in Egypt and where it's going?
Oh, right, OK, yeah. Well, I mean, I tend to agree with Martin. I mean, anything to do with, you know, a spontaneous sort of demonstration against a dictatorship, you know, is something you can't actually predict. I mean, all we can hope is that, you know, there will be some stability and an alternative. Because, I mean, that's the problem. There is actually no alternative, a government and democratic process actually available to the people of Egypt. I always worry when there is a vacuum that it's filled by people who are, you know, not necessarily going to have their best interests at heart. And as Martin has said, there are obviously other aspects to this, particularly the relationship with Israel, which has always been perplexing to a lot of us, in the background here. And the Americans, yet again, have not covered themselves in glory with their policy. Okay.